Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Time for another edition of Garden Talk. Back once again, Mike Maddox, Rock County UW Extension Horticulture Educator, who also is Director of Education at the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville. Mike, great to have you back.
Good to be here.
And Mark Dwyer with us as well. Mark's the horticulturist, landscape manager at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. And Mark, great to see you again.
Likewise, Larry.
How are things at the Rotary Gardens? Mark, we can talk about that for a minute.
Sure. Things are going absolutely wonderfully. We've had a great summer. I would encourage people who haven't visited this year to shoot down to Janesville or up to Janesville and take a look at what we have. We're just a little bit past peak, but still lots of summer color. And with these cooler mornings, we're starting to see that slide towards autumn. So lots of wonderful things going on at the gardens and a great time of year to visit.
Yeah, and I would say this Saturday would probably be a good day to do it. We've got a lot going on with our garden festival. We'll have actually free admission to the gardens, too.
Mm-hmm.
So this
perfect.
Is a good weekend, and there'll be things going on. We got free tours of the gardens, taste testing of the tomatoes. Once again, Janesville Area Herb Society doing fried green tomatoes. There's just a lot going on this Saturday.
Okay, and all day long?
11 to 4.
11 to 4. Okay, there we have it. And we also have calls online, so we might as well. We'll get to you in just a minute here, but what are some of the things that you're seeing in the Janesville area? Any problems or what kinds of questions are you most often getting?
Well, right before this, I was catching up on questions, and I think most of them had to do with lawns.
Is that right?
We've gone all summer long without any lawn questions, but I think the heat last week really pushed a lot of the grasses into dormancy. So people are just now coming in with my lawns turn brown type questions.
Oh, okay.
Because it was just really hot down there, and I think though it was warm all summer, I really think the lawns had it pretty easy with the rain and the moisture we had in our area. But finally, we just had a lot of these, my lawns turning brown questions. And until I get more information from these individuals or see samples, I'm going to just say I think it was just the heat pushing our cool season grasses into dormancy.
I know I've heard from a couple of golfing friends who have been in different parts of the state, and some of the golf courses, especially the greens, suffered lots of rain, and then heat came in, mm-hmm. and some of the not all the courses certainly, but a few of the courses were affected.
And some of that combination of heat and moisture has caused some disease problems.
Yeah,
but you know that's a lot of golf course areas.
Anne in Cloquet, Minnesota. Let's turn to you. Hi, Anne. Thank you for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a strange looking creature eating the leaves off my sand cherry shrub. It has a red head, horizontal stripes across the body that are black and gold, and a raised yellow tail, like kind of like an airplane, some of the airplane-style tails. It is so bizarre, and it's a ferocious eater. It's just exfoliating that tree.
So it's a tree it's on?
No, it's a shrub. It's approximately 4 to 5 foot tall.
I would say it's sand cherry, and there's so many things that can chew on that.
How big is that insect, by the way?
Varies from 1 to 2 inches long. I have approximately...
That's a big one.
12 to 14 that I can see on the plant, so it's...
Well, I would say I'm not an entomologist, and the picture that I'm putting in my mind's of some freaky little monster chewing on the plant. I think we want to get it ID'd just out of curiosity's sake. If you could take it to your county extension office and have them forward it to either a picture of it to Phil Pelletieri. Thank you very much. Have it forwarded onto our insect diagnostic specialist. We can get it ID'd. And I think out of curiosity's sake, that'd be interesting.
It is really a strange looking thing. I have never seen it before in my life.
But yeah. I don't think it's going to kill it. That's my guess. Yeah, kill your sand cherry, that is. It's probably this late in the season.
Right.
Those leaves are going to be falling off anyways. It's going to be done for the year.
You should get a picture of it and send it to the insect diagnostic lab.
Yeah.
You know, I'm wondering if this is some kind of good thing that'll turn into something nice, or is it bad bug?
Phil will probably have an answer for you.
Well, I hope so.
All right.
Very good. Thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. Bridget in Madison, your turn. Hi, Bridget.
I just have a question. I recently moved into a very sunny apartment, and my roommates and I are interested in starting to do some gardening in pots. And I was wondering if there was any advice about what thrives indoors during the fall and winter in a sunny apartment. So I'll take my answer off
Do you have, before you leave, do you have a, are you on the first floor, second floor?
We are on the first floor.
So you have a patio as well?
Yep, and a yard. But we want to be able to grow throughout the winter, so.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, the real concern with growing plants inside during the winter in particular is the solar angles. You know, plants that might thrive with some summer sun coming through your windows will struggle in winter. And I've seen people try to bring herbs inside, and even with a southern exposure or a western exposure, there's issues with it establishing. So I would recommend talking to a local garden center and seeing what sort of plants are available. There's certainly lots of house plants that would do well, but if your intent is growing produce or herbs or something of that nature, you'll need supplemental lighting, and the watering regime is very important. So it's entirely possible, but you need to do a little more research before you dive right in.
So she would need a southern exposure for a good southern exposure? Even then, you'd have problems, wouldn't you?
Southern exposures can sometimes get too hot, definitely in the summertime, so you'd want to...
But in the winter...
In the wintertime, it would be helpful. The sun intensity will still be less. If she's trying to do vegetables or herbs indoors, as Mark said, there'll be some issues. If she just wanted to stick with houseplants, I think a nice foolproof one is something like philodendron or pothos.
Yeah.
Try those. If you don't kill those, then let's move up to something a little more tricky. Yeah.
All right, Dan in Partyville, on to you. Hi, Dan.
Morning. Hi, how are you?
Good.
I got a question about raspberries.
Okay.
I have no idea what kind they are. My wife's been transplanting them from around the yard for the last couple of years. They're bearing lots of fruit, but a lot of the fruits themselves, especially up toward where they attach to the canes, have white splotches on the action, not dots, but like the top of the... It's almost like a translucent, milky-looking white. It's not milky, but it looks just like a milky color. And we haven't been picking them. We were wondering what that is. Is that from the heat? Because a lot of our tomatoes fried right on the vine.
I'll just jump in here and say that of all the gardening questions coming in, when I hear somebody say it's raspberries, I cringe. I like raspberries and jams and that, but when you guys have questions on them, I am not a raspberry grower. But I don't want to leave you hanging like that. We do have resources out there to get you connected. With that answer, as I'm looking at what Larry's doing right now, I think he's trying to pull up something online. We have a great publication out there on growing raspberries in Wisconsin through the learningstore.uwax.edu.
Okay.
And I would start there.
All right.
And if your problem is a common one, it should be listed in that.
Okay. It's not all of the fruit. It's just kind of random. That's why I was wondering if it's perhaps the heat.
Yeah.
I was just pulling something up, and I was reading here that full sun creates white spots on raspberries.
Is that harmful to them, or do you not want to harvest them? Or
my guess, it's going to be something like a sun scald on them, almost like a sunburn.
Yeah.
And usually when something like that happens, they become doorways for other type of bacteria or pathogens to get in that can cause a bit of a rot.
Well, we should probably pick those fruits and get rid of them.
I think I'm going to have to say use your discretion.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you, guys.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And here we get a lawn question from Stephen Eau Claire. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I've got an older lawn that's really rough because of moles and gophers over the years, so I'm going to level it with a Harley rake and then overseed it because it's a little thin and there's some places where it's full of crabgrass that I've killed with Roundup. I'm wondering how late I can seed it and still have it germinate and get a good start.
Actually, you're getting into a good season for that, isn't it?
And also, what variety of grasses I should use.
Is it a shady lawn or a full sun?
Mostly full sun, sandy loam soil, and it's irrigated.
All right.
Okay.
I would say you're up a little further north, so I'm trying to skew things for your time. Yeah, Larry's right. This is coming to the perfect time for starting some new lawn. The season will be the grass will be. I can't talk today. I'm just going to that. The soil should be nice and warm, so things should germinate fairly quickly. And if you get good seed soil contact, all the better. As for what to grow a good mix is recommended, something containing the Kentucky bluegrass, fine fescues, in some sort of 50-50 ratio or whatever. That would give your yard the nice mix it needs of good lawn-type grasses for full sun. You may want to consider using a bit of a phosphorus starter fertilizer. That'll help give things a little bit of a jump start when doing the grass from seed. And also make sure you pay particular attention to watering. You're going to probably need to water things daily, if not twice a day, for a good 15, 20 days this time of year, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what the weather you're having up there is, though.
It rained all summer, but now it seems to have stopped.
Yeah. So the big thing you're going to need to do is make sure that seed stays moist. Doesn't need to be saturated, but just moist every day until it's all completely germinated. And again, that might take 15, 20 days, depending on the weather.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Kelly in Northeast Iowa emailed in to say that for more than 7 years, had a great stand of hollyhocks that reseed themselves, stayed beautiful year after year. This year, which was exceptionally wet in Northeast Iowa, the second year plants all became badly infected with hollyhock rust. They were all dead by the end of July. Right now, the first year plants appear okay with no signs of infection. Will hollyhock rust live in the soil? Are the odds high that my plants will be reinfected next year? I'm trying to decide if I should replant my hollyhock garden with some other type of plant. And I don't know. What do you think? Mark, you have a
thought? That's a real good question. We had a tough year with hollyhocks as well, and I understand her concern with reinfection. I guess I'm not familiar enough with the rust issue to know if that can reinfect. I think that would be something to, again, pass along to a local extension agent and do a little research on, because you certainly don't want to put the time, effort, and expense into putting in a new colony and having it just perpetually infected year after year. So this year in particular was just extremely tough with the humidity and rain, and our hollyhocks were actually we're tearing all ours out right now and putting in plugs similar to what she's considering.
I was going to say, just for some general advice regarding any kind of foliage disease on your plants, good sanitation is important. Make sure you clean up all that debris, compost it properly, or send it to the local municipal waste place, and get it off your property. And that should slow reinfection in the future.
And Sherry from Nakusa emails, thinking about putting in peonies as a foundation shrub next to her house, but I heard that they attract ants. Is that true? Is there any way I should be able to keep the ants out of the house if I plant peonies next to the house? I don't know that that's necessarily...
Well, there is some sort of connection between ants and peonies, and I've heard a lot of different theories about it. Typically when ants get in the house, though, that is more of a sanitation problem for indoors. You've left food out, you've have sticky surfaces, or something's fallen under the table or something like that. To keep ants out of the house, I have to say, do good housekeeping. But as for peonies and more inside household pests, I don't think there really is a connection.
Also, would a white poplar tree do okay in zone 4? White poplar in zone 4? In sandy soil? Wondering if they're susceptible to wind damage or diseases as well. She's wondering about the root system, what it's like on a poplar. It's pretty... Is it shallow, isn't it?
It's shallow. I'll say white poplar would be hardy there. A concern would be we have a huge one in our arboretum, and the growth rate is extraordinary. Not real long-lived, and an issue we're seeing are root suckers. And as with many of the poplars, you think of quaking aspens and such, they create massive colonies. So this specimen we have in our arboretum, as we mow around it, we're mowing up all these little shoots in a, you know, about a 2,000-square-foot area. So if it's in a natural area and a colony is okay, it's a absolutely beautiful tree, and again, very fast-growing and adaptable, but again, should be aware of those issues.
Okay. Mark Dwyer and Mike Maddox, our guests today, both work out of the Rotary Gardens in Janesville. Mike's also a UW Extension horticulture educator. Here on Garden Talk, Jim Packard, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On Garden Talk, Larry Mueller here with my guests Mark Dwyer and Mike Maddox. Thank you so much for listening in. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Maddie in Waupaca. Hi, Maddie.
Hi. We have a large flower garden, and we have hundreds of yellow, medium-sized yellow butterflies. And we're wondering whether we should just enjoy watching them or if they're a pest of some kind that we don't know about.
Well, the concern with, you know, with butterflies, when you say medium size, in my mind, it could be a couple different things. And I'm no butterfly expert. But, you know, I think with insects, if the concern was that it was something negative, at this point, control would affect a lot of other insects. You wouldn't go out there spraying or anything like that. That would take away a lot of the beneficial. So my vote would be to just enjoy them because they're a late stage of something. They could be a sulfur, which is a really neat little butterfly. But without proper ID, it's tough to make a recommendation.
They would, and the damage probably would have been done when they were in the larval stage. So
yeah. Most times the caterpillars are the one doing all the feeding, so you can sit back and enjoy these. Again, if you want an ID, get one into your local county extension office, and if they don't know it, we can shoot a picture off to campus to get it identified.
Uh-huh. All right. Thanks very much for calling. And let's see. Let's take Jane in Sun Prairie next, I believe. Jane, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thank you for calling.
I have a quick question.
Okay.
We had to replace our septic system at our cabin in central Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
And we now have a bigger septic system with a mound.
Yes.
And we had to clear away deciduous and conifers for the mound. And it's right up against a fence that fences off a private road. And we're wondering, instead of planting trees there, which may not be the best choice.
Wouldn't be a good choice. Right.
Are there any tall shrubs or anything that I can plant along there to kind of screen the area?
Prairie plants work.
Yeah, as Larry alluded to, prairie plants are even considering ornamental grasses. You know, of course, they'd have to be adaptable to your, presumably, again, sandy soils. But there's a lot of shrubs that would do very well. The concern there is not getting those that become large shrubs / small trees that have extensive root systems as well.
Right.
Because in 20 years, you're in the same boat with issues. But mm-hmm. Going with shallow-rooted, smaller shrubs, things like spireas or ninebarks, excuse me, there's so many things out there. But again, the concern would be the rooting. So maybe getting a second opinion as you're looking at selections is in regards to what the rooting would be. Because
mm-hmm.
when you consider sandy soils, there's going to be some significant rooting for moisture, obviously. So
Right. Amending
those soils may help keep that root layer a little bit higher and of course, benefit the shrubs. But don't feel it's a limitation. It's really an opportunity to explore some things that will be adaptable and appropriate for your area of the state.
Yeah, I think it should be okay. And I do have about 15 feet between where the mound meets the ground and then the fence. So I've got some room.
So you could plant. You're talking about planting on the other side of the mound then as a screen?
Right.
Okay.
I'm not talking about planting on the mound.
You could. What are you putting on the mound?
Eventually we're going to put ornamental grasses.
Okay.
So you directed me to a website at the Minnesota Extension, and they had wonderful resources.
Perfect. Okay.
For grasses. So, but it was, where would I go to find out about more bushes?
Okay, so you want, so not on the mound system, you want something as a screen between the road and the mound.
Correct.
And you've got 18 feet to work with.
About 15, right.
Yeah. Oh, well, there's lots of opportunities there, I would think.
Uh-huh. I think so.
Mark?
Yeah, lots of resources. I think online you can find all sorts of things. The limitation with some books is that they're very regional in nature, so finding something with local applicability is important. But your situation sounds exciting because when you consider your shrubs, consider something with interesting foliage. You know, a band of green, once you establish that, your grasses won't show as well. So I recommend getting into the interesting foliage types, whether it's variegated dogwoods or colorful ninebark, something that has... growing season appeal, not just a little poof of flowers or late season fall color. You want something that has interest year-round and will create a nice foil for something in the foreground as you establish things on your mound.
I see.
Oh, makes sense. Thank you for calling.
Thank you so much.
Good luck. Bill in Hayward, on to you now. Hi, Bill.
Hey, I just wanted to comment about that gal who wanted to grow vegetables in her house in the wintertime.
Yeah.
We grow sprouts. We grow bean, alfalfa, radish, broccoli, French lentils, flax, and sesame. And there's a guy in southern Wisconsin, I think he's in Franklin, that sells the Easy Sprouter. And it's really nice. You can have fresh vegetables all winter long and have some really nice sprout salads. That's all.
Do you use grow lights?
No. Actually, they grow best in the dark. I stack my sprouters up on top of my refrigerator so the heat from the coil on the or compressor on the back of the refrigerator heats up the sprouter, and that's how they grow. You don't need any sunlight.
All right. Sprouts, a good idea. I like sprouts, too.
Yeah.
Just had a nice sprout salad a couple nights ago, as a matter of fact. Good points. Thanks, Bill.
Yep. Have a good day.
Appreciate it. All right. Let's go to Carla in Wittenberg. Hi, Carla.
Good morning, Mr. Mueller. How are you?
Just fine. How are you?
I'm good, too. I have a question about my Maynight salvias. The leaves are looking really eaten, and I've been using a spray that is for, like, bugs and diseases on roses. And I've been fertilizing them, but they still look really bad. The stems are dying back. The site is very hot. And I'm thinking maybe it's just a little too hot there for them. So I don't know if I should try to pamper them or if I could maybe get a suggestion for a different kind of plant that's about that same size, but maybe, you know, something that can take a little more heat.
Okay. Mark, what do you think?
Well, before you give up on that salvia, let me tell you what we do with our Maynight salvias is the way they need to be dealt with is, of course, they're wonderful bloomers in May. They look great.
Yeah.
As soon as those flowers start to lose their color, when they're not even bluish violet, when they're almost brown, which is typically by mid-June, we cut the entire plant down to 2 inches. And we're getting rid of that older foliage. We get a fresh flush of foliage. And frequently we'll get a rebloom in July. So the comment about salvia is don't just rely on that 2 to 3 weeks in spring. You can get them to rebloom, get a fresh flush of foliage. Now, if it's a perpetual issue with decline on your salvia, consider things like sedums. Veronicas are a little more tolerant of drier soils. But I feel, salvias are a quick blip on the radar of spring unless you, again, really butcher them back severely and rely on that fresh foliage and another flush of blooms.
Okay, so do you think I could cut them all the way back right now?
It's a little late because what's going to happen is you'll get new growth, and by the time that's kind of ripening up, you won't get new blooms this late in the game, but frost will knock back your new growth. For sanitation, go ahead and cut it back, but realize you're just going to have to cut it back again in October after your frost. But don't give up on it. It's a great salvia, but, again, extend the interest.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Mike emails to say that Rabbit stripped his lilies and that were unfenced. Will the bulbs develop enough without foliage and flower for next year, or should he replace those bulbs with new bulbs?
Before I give up on him, I think I'd, a compromise would be to interplant with the ones that have been nibbled, put some new ones in there, whether it's a new variety or the same variety. But we've had a lot of browsing in our garden as well, and in my experience with lilies is it would take about 2 years of real heavy repeated browsing to kill it. So you're going to see another plant next year. However, it may be a little bit smaller, a little bit on the leaner side, but I wouldn't totally give up on him, I guess.
And Sandy from Wausau says his variegated dogwood has small rusty spots on the leaves. Anything you guys know?
Could be sunburn, could be a bit of a anthracnose-like leaf spot. Could be a variety of things. I'm going to guess it's going to be cosmetic.
Okay, there we go. Jean and Glidden, we'll go to you now. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I wanted to ask if it's okay to transplant peony bushes now, or is it too late in the year?
Now is perfect. We transplant ours up well through September, so you've hit the time of year. Go for it.
Okay.
Perfect timing.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Debbie lives in Duluth, Minnesota, wondering if you know why aspen tree trunks in her area are turning black. I see no bugs or animal holes in the trees, but the trunks are turning black.
I would say you're talking to two folks from the southern part of the state. I have no clue.
Yeah.
I can't even venture a guess right now.
My guess is it's not something that's really affecting the tree. I think it could be something because of the humidity and such that's forming.
Sometimes
on the trunk.
It could be like a sooty mold, or it could just be the maturation of the trunk tissue. I need
it
to see a picture.
Yeah, we need to see a picture of that one. Don in Savannah, Illinois. Let's go to you now. Hi, Don.
Hello there. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I've got a couple of questions about onions. I know you're not into vegetables, but one of them was a genetics thing that just fascinated me. I like to grow red onions, and I've had fair to decent luck with them for several years. And I had some hybrid red onions last year, and they grew a couple of them and saved seed, which I know you're not supposed to do, but I did. And what fascinated me, I expected to be a Duke's mixture of anything and expect anything, you know, being hybrid. But I got real uniform onions that were kind of a light yellow and not real good. They're not near as good as the red ones. And I'm just curious why they were so uniform.
Huh? Could have.
I don't know. I could make up answers for you if you'd like. When you were dealing with the genetics of it, and depending on what was cross-pollinated, you know, who was mom and who was dad particularly, that could affect the gene expression of what's coming out. I think when we're doing our backyard plant breeding, we got too many wild cards for us to be able to venture a guess via the radio here.
But it's definitely a gene thing. Who was mom? Who was dad? And that's going to affect whether or not you get a very uniform growth.
All in the gene expression.
All in the gene expression. There you go, Don. Thanks for calling. Oliver in Lancaster, let's go to you next. Hi, Oliver.
Hello. It's just a curiosity question. When I was a kid on the farm in Minnesota, my dad planted some trees called Chinese elm. And I remember they grew quite fast, but kind of were short-lived. Is that tree still around, or?
That could have been a local name for.
Yeah, when we go to common names, it's hard to say. As for the Chinese elm, so many were brought over here for some of the breeding programs to help breed Dutch elm disease-resistant trees. And I remember talking to an old arborist. You know, I was 20, he was 80, and he had some very colorful, inappropriate names to share right now regarding Chinese elms because of their short life. And I'll just say he pretty much summed it up as they were a garbage tree. But with using a common name, we need to know specifically which type of elm you're looking at, because there can be some good imports regarding the elms and that. So I'm sure they're around. I'm sure they're existing in some back alleys here and there, self-seeding in some vacated woodlots. But I doubt you're going to find any for sale.
Yeah, I remember they were very quick growing, but if you had any wind at all, you had branches and stuff laying all over. So I guess that guy's description of garbage was quite appropriate.
There you go.
That was, like I said, it was just a curiosity thing from when I was a kid.
Oh. Well, it could have been a common name. There are Chinese elms. Mm-hmm. You know, you can go online and you'll find some comments about them. But who knows from back then? Janet in Oak Creek, we'll go to you. Hi, Janet.
Hello. I have a question regarding hickories. I just recently found out the hickory is related to the black walnut. And obviously there's always so much discussion about the and the toxicity of it. So are hickories also toxic? The nuts, the leaves, and it's put way back in the backyard because of the mess, but do I have to be concerned because I have tons of garden?
Now, when we, because I've looked this up several times before, walnuts and hickories are both in the Juglanaceae family, so they're basically cousins in a way. All members of the Juglanaceae family produce the substance juglone at some level. I believe black walnuts do a little more than the hickories. That substance is produced in all parts of the plant, and it can have a negative effect on some other plants around it, especially like tomatoes. So that said, yes, there can be some concern with it, with a hickory in the garden. I would think I would avoid composting, those leaves into the vegetable garden. But boy, I really don't want to give up a hickory tree.
No, it's beautiful, and it's one that I insisted on having when I built my my home. I had great memories of it as a child, so just try to keep the nuts out of the garden
And the leaves.
And the leaves. Okay.
And the other thing is, too, if you do notice you're having problems with certain plants in your garden, we do have a publication out there about juglone toxicity and plants for the yard. You might want to take a look at that to see what are some suggestions to plant and what are some suggestions of things to avoid.
One other real quick question. What about the nuts? I'm sure I have the bitter nut. And why do people just discourage eating them? Growing up, we always ate them. We dried them and we ate them as a great snack. And I understand they are wonderful for cooking. Why do you hear so many negative things about the nut of the hickory?
I've not heard anything about eating it, perhaps
it's a taste issue.
I would say it's bitter nut. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And boy, more callers online here. It looks like another tree question coming up from Rayzard in Viroqua. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I was just wondering if there's a certain thing I got to do that to save one those, I got like an evergreen tree, but it's in a family of evergreens. It's not an evergreen tree, and they're dying. Last year I lost one, and this year I totally lost the other one. The bark's starting to peel off just like on the first one, and you got highways in there. I don't know what's causing that. I bet it's kind of some kind of insect.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn to Mark Dwyer. Mark?
Well, without seeing the exact location, this will be a little bit of a guess, but I imagine with the close proximity to the highway, there's issues of salt spray, which can travel quite a distance. You go along any significant highway and you'll see evergreens, whether it's pines or arborvitae or what have you, with significant damage even 50 feet from the roadway. So could be a salt issue. If there was any construction originally with the highway that created a change in grade around those trees, more soil around the roots, it could be a matter of time before they just sequentially die. So I imagine your current evergreen or tree is being affected similarly to the other one, the same effect. So it's tough, again, to hazard a guess, but I think it's just a tough growing condition for it based on multiple factors.
Well, these trees are like 10 years old. I mean, they're fully grown. Not fully grown, but they'll grow some more. But I'm on a dead end. There's no salt problem here, but I just hate to see I hate to lose another one.
Yeah.
Did you water them?
No, I never watered them. I bought them when they were just little saplings.
Okay. You know, there's probably just a lot of different factors we need to look at, like soil and location, and probably nothing we're going to be able to get into right now. But if you can shoot a picture off to your county extension agent or to one of us, we could probably take a look at it. Maybe, you know, a picture's worth 1,000 words, if not more. That'll help us identify something in there that could be a problem for you. And yeah, it could be a disease issue, can be an insect issue.
Could be an insect issue.
Could be a combination of all the above.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things we've got to do, is just try to figure out what are all the issues and what's the most likely candidate.
So if you can take a few pictures and send them in to...
you can send them to me if you'd like at my email. So it'd be
what's your email address?
First name dot last name. So Mike.Maddox, MADDOX.
So it's Mike dot.
Yeah, they got that period in between the two. Yeah.
Let's do this a little slower. I'm not as fast as you guys.
Right. Well, I was going to say, I think it's on the website too. I thought you listed it. I don't
know. Oh, it's probably listed on our Facebook page.
Okay.
Yeah.
So go to the Facebook page, The Larry Mealer Show. That's my Facebook page. I actually have two Facebook pages. One's kind of a personal one. One's kind of the radio station one. The radio station one is The Larry Mealer Show, although you could look on the other page, too. You just wouldn't find the information you need.
I would say you could just type in any of our names. I'm sure it's going to come up with the email address. That's one of the joys of working for the university.
Yep. There you go.
Okay. That's Miller with a double L?
M-E-I-L-L-E-R.
Okay.
All right. Thank good. You. Thanks a lot for calling. And let's see. We got Marie emailed us, and who really enjoys the Garden Talk shows. And she says, we're going back to those medium-sized yellow butterflies. She feels they're definitely yellow sulfurs because they're around by the dozens everywhere in the Trempealeau area. And she used to hatch monarchs for a project with children. So please don't kill those butterflies. And I think we were saying that, too. Please don't kill those butterflies. And then she had a comment about last week's show, and lupines or lupins, they can become unsightly and black, but unless you're leaving the flower stalks there for reseeding, something they readily do, the spent flower stems and foliage can be cut back after the first blooming, and there's a rebloom at the end of the summer. So that goes along with what we were talking about. Helen in Fond du Lac, on to you now. Hi, Helen.
Hi. Hi. You were talking about the sprouts from,
yes,
a few minutes ago. I was in the car, so I didn't get it. But my question is, if I wanted to sprout any of these vegetables, do I use the same seeds, the same package of vegetable seeds I would use to plant in the garden?
I've not done this as for sprouts. I've had them or ate them, so I think we need to do a little more homework on it. So.
I'm sure we'll get some calls on this. Yeah. And there are actually bean sprouts that you can buy you plant and they come up as sprouts.
Yeah.
Not necessarily planting, say, carrots or radishes.
Yeah. Well, and I also think you need to look at the methods to do it. I think you're probably changing the density that you're planting them in, some of this medium that you're using. We definitely need more information out there.
I know I used to sprout alfalfa sprouts. And I got seeds for that. But I had to get special seeds. I think the seeds that you plant in the garden sometimes are coated with stuff, aren't they?
Sometimes they can be, yeah.
Yeah. And that's why I wondered where this fellow said he had radishes and everything else, and where did he get those seeds that he sprouted on top of his refrigerator?
Well, maybe he'll call back and we'll get some information from him about what exactly he did.
All right, thanks.
Yeah. All right, we'll let him call back. Usually we don't have people call twice in a week, but this we'll make an exception.
And I'm sure, like everything else out there, there's a whole website devoted to it.
And I'm pretty sure you're right about that, Mike. Mike Maddox, our guest, and Mark Dwyer, they both work out of the Rotary Gardens in Janesville, Wisconsin. Larry Mealer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mealer with my guests Mark Dwyer and Mike Maddox. And you guys have a beautiful calendar for 2011, the Rotary Botanical Gardens calendar. I've got a copy here. It looks great.
Well, thank you. That'll be $22. but for anyone else who visits the gardens, they're $10. We put together a great calendar, and it's been available for about a month now, and it includes lots of garden images, and this is the time of year people are looking for calendars, and we do encourage people when they come to visit to pick one up. It's very nice, very affordable, and does help support the gardens, and as a nonprofit, we need all the help we can get.
Can you order them off your website?
No.
Can't order them off the website. You have to show up to get them.
Have to show up, right.
All right. All right. Well, that's just because otherwise people will be looking.
Oh, that would be great, but that's not available right now.
Okay. Let's go to Pat in East Troy next. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Larry and guests. Thank you for taking my call. I bought a hothouse raised lily as a commemorative gift for my ex-husband at Easter time. And it went through its usual life cycle, and about a month later, it died. And I didn't throw it out until a few days later, and at that time there were sprouts coming up out of what had been the root system, apparently. They grew and grew. They are now three or 4 feet tall and very skinny. I'm going to have to transplant it into the earth. Is there any hope that it'll make it through the winter, or will it survive, or will it ever bloom again?
What do you think, Mark?
Oh, I think it's certainly worth a try. Most people don't realize Easter lilies or the early season lilies are hardy. They've just been forced out of season, and for their fragrance and for that timing. And, of course, florists will have these year-round for various events. The curveball for you is you're planting it fairly late. Ideally, of course, if you knew it was still alive, you would have done it sooner. But I'd get it in the ground today and keep it watered, and I think you'll be fine. It sometimes will take up to 2 years to get back on schedule with these lilies, but definitely worth a try, and do it today if you can.
Does it go in full sun or shade?
Full sun.
Okay, that's what I needed to know.
All right, thanks a lot, Pat, for calling. Helen in West Salem, your turn. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I'm calling about my rhubarb. It never went to seed, and I quit eating it about the 1st of July, which you're supposed to do. So I'm just wondering, is it still safe to pull and eat? What do you think?
Thinking. You know, I would still go with the normal schedule. I think it's more of a heat thing. I'm trying to think what it is with rhubarb. That I think when it gets so far along in the summertime, the heat kind of changes the chemicals in the tissue, and that's what causes it to be unpalatable at times. So I would just wait till next year.
Better safe than sorry.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks for calling. And here we've got Chris calling on behalf of parents. They have two beautiful maples in their yard in Brookfield. One is a sugar maple, the other a red. The problem is that the leaves on both trees are turning white along the veins of the leaves and prematurely drying up and falling from the tree. I've walked around the neighborhood, couldn't find any other maples that were suffering from anything similar. Both trees are mature, about 2 feet in diameter. That'd be a water issue.
I'm thinking any number of things. I'd like to see actually what these white veins look like, mm-hmm. To know, you know, because part of me wants to say powdery mildew. Whenever somebody says white on leaves, I think powdery mildew, but it may be something different. I'm going to have to tell them what I tell a lot of people, and go to your county extension office and bring some leaves there. That will really help them, or bring a picture and bring a branch in to have it diagnosed. And I'd do it sooner rather than later. Because if it is a severe problem, it's easier to do something with at the early stages versus the later stages.
And, you know, the maples, we've had some trouble. Actually, I think it goes back a couple years when we had such dry conditions, and people who didn't water their trees ran into problems with their maples like it now.
Yeah, a lot of water stress issues start to come or become apparent in the later time in each summer. That water stress issue can be anywhere from construction damage to root rots to girdling roots to who knows what else is going on out there. But usually the symptoms are discoloring of leaves, early fall coloration, early leaf drop. If you start seeing all that kind of stuff going on right now, it's time to do some homework to see what's gone on around that tree in the last several years that could have caused this damage.
Mary Beth in Menominee would like to know why her moonflowers have beautiful leaves and buds on them, look very healthy, but will not open up and flower.
Well, hopefully she's looking at night. They're a night bloomer in the Morning Glory family. The issue with moonflowers, if you have a lot of lush foliage and few buds, it's typically overly rich soil. And we've had the same issue. We've tried to grow moonflowers many times at the gardens, and our soil's just so darn rich. We get very vigorous vines and very few flowers. Mm-hmm. I would encourage her to keep looking and get out there with a flashlight at dusk and in the evening and hope for the best. It sounds like it wants to bloom, but again, maybe just a lot of focus on foliage growth even this late in the season.
Yeah, maybe it's if you've been fertilizing, don't anymore.
Mm-hmm.
let the fertilizing go. Richard in Platteville. Your turn. Hi, Richard.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Good. Listen, I'd like to, about 22 years ago,
I planted, we built a new home, and we put in sugar maple trees along our driveway. Not driveway, but along the road coming down our place. And we also put silver maple in, et cetera, et cetera, about 20 of them. Well, the sugar maple are all dying. That's the fourth one now. They're going to be finished in another year. And I called and talked to somebody before, and they said, well, that's kind of the life of a tree, especially if they were planted incorrectly, which probably I did. But anyway, they're going to come out. I'd like to know what kind of tree would I plant, which you recommend to plant that's healthy, that grows quickly, and that will complement the silver maple that are in there now. They're about 50, 60 feet tall by now. So,
okay. Mark, what do you think?
Well, it kind of depends. If you're soured on maples, you could move on to some other things. You know, with your dictate of having it grow fast, you could look into things like hackberries are nice. You could look into hybrid elms. We talked earlier about Chinese elms, but the hybrid elms, particularly, there's five varieties that came out of the Morton Arboretum Research Program that are actually a quarter Chinese elm. Very quick growing. They have that vase-shaped look. Fall color is marginal. It's yellowish, so fall color is not a huge factor, but the hybrid elms we have at Rotary Gardens are growing 2 to 3 foot a year, which is an amazing growth rate. If you're not soured on maples, you might want to consider the Freemanii maples, which are a silver red cross. So you get the nice quick growth rate and the fall color. And those tend to be overplanted. They're just about everywhere, but they do fit the bill for nice fall color and a quick growth rate. Your soil will also be a consideration in recommending something. I used to like lindens a lot, but the Japanese beetles are tearing those up. So, again, there are some limitations with your selections.
All right.
Okay, good. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for calling. Might even run a little soil test. Wouldn't hurt. And send it in and explain to the Soil and Plant Analysis Lab, explain what you want to grow in that spot, trees, and you'll get some recommendations back. And that that's not a bad thing to do at all.
Soil pH would be an issue for a lot of trees. If it gets too high or too low, it's going to affect their growth.
All right. Let's go to Frank in Cedarburg. Frank, hello to you.
Hi. Thanks for taking a call.
Sure.
I have a situation where I have some daylilies and some seed. Now, what is the secret to germinating those seeds?
Okay. Do they need a cold?
Oh, I've not done them from seeds. I've done them all just from divisions. What we'd have to do is figure out what are the requirements, which, of course, that's what you're calling for. We need to know if they need to be treated with cold. Sometimes you can just do that by putting it in your refrigerator for a period of time. Some seeds require to have some sort of scar put on them, something that cuts through the seed coat that allow moisture to get in to allow germination to occur. I have to say right now, without my handy dandy plant propagation book, I'm going to have to leave it at that. I know the information's out there. We can probably do a web search, or somebody else can call in who have experience. I mean, people are doing home breeding of plants all the time, so somebody out there is probably listening.
Well, and there's a Wisconsin Daylily Society. They have a website. They're a great resource. And also the American Daylily Society. So enormous organizations. I think you'd cut to the chase and get right to the answers you need. But as Mike alluded to, division's a real quick way to do it. And that's how we continue to propagate these plants.
All right. There you go. Thanks for calling. And Lisa in Eau Claire was wondering if you could recommend a generally good spray for a bush when you don't know what kind it is or what's eating it. It has green, white, variegated leaves, and they start to get holy and then they're gone completely. Doesn't seem to start at the bottom, at the top or bottom, and spread. It's all over at the same time, so it's not starting at the top or not starting at the bottom. It's a sort of attack.
And she wants to know what to spray it with.
Yeah.
Water.
Yeah.
Yeah. We need to know what the insect is specifically before we can make any recommendations. Chemicals can pollute the environment, do damage. I just don't want to make a recommendation without knowing specifically what we're targeting.
Unless she went with maybe an insecticidal soap. But you really, as Mike said, you want to see what's there. But going the safe route before you have to put on a mask and spray poison.
Mary in Sugar Island, hello.
Hi. I'm calling because I know that I had bought seeds for sprouting from Young's Garden Center, so I looked on their catalog since I have one out.
Yeah.
And you can buy a BioStarter sprouter, for $18, and you can do three sprouts at a time. I've never used that. And then they list all the special seeds that they have that you can buy for sprouting. They have alfalfa, broccoli, Chinese cabbage, mung bean, radish, and a sprout mix.
Perfect.
And so those are they're special, they're untreated, they're natural, and they're high germinating.
So that's from the Jung's seed catalog.
Yeah, and I have a number here if you'd like it.
Sure, why not?
1-800-247-5864.
1-800-247-5864.
Yes, that's correct.
Mary, thank you so much. Appreciate
sure.
it.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Appreciate that call. So we've got the sprouting seeds issue resolved here with a call from Mary and Jung's again, 1-800-247-5864. Talking today with Mark Dwyer, horticulturist and landscape manager at the Rotary Garden in Janesville, Mike Maddox, Rock County UW Extension Horticulture Educator and Director of Education at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with Mark Dwyer and Mike Maddox. Both work at the Rotary Gardens in Janesville, Wisconsin. Take a look at their website. They got a nice website. It's Rotary Gardens with an S, rotarygardens.org. And you find out how to get there and take a look at some of the great photos and other information they have on their website. I think you'll like it. If you haven't seen it, you should get to Janesville and take a look. It's really quite nice and just off the interstate, too. So it's been there many times myself, and it's just a couple minutes, really, off the interstate. So it's pretty handy from no matter where you are in the state. We have callers online with questions for you guys. So let's go right back to the phones. And Scott in Evansville, you're up. Thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I have lilacs that used to bloom all the time, and probably like 4 or 5 years ago we trimmed them back, probably to about 4 feet high, and they haven't bloomed since. And there's two plants, and they get sun in the morning and early afternoon, and then they don't get any sun at you know, obviously yeah. like after two or so.
Yeah, I think you went about the trimming wrong. Mike, what do you think?
Well, if you did it 5 years ago, he should have enough regrowth unless you're doing that every year.
No, we haven't trimmed it back at all.
Okay. It could be, though it is getting light, it may not be enough light, because if it's just getting morning light, that's not as intense as anything later in the afternoon.
And they're surrounded by arborvitae, on one side arborvitae, and then just some evergreen bushes on the bases.
Yeah.
I wonder if that has anything to do with it.
Yeah, and in 5 years, those arborvitae probably got bigger, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're a lot bigger.
Yeah, they could be blocking some of the light. If you're not pruning it, we can't blame you for that.
It could be... another thought is deer. Yeah, deer browsing over the winter could remove flower buds as well. Do you have a deer issue?
No, we're just outside of town, but we don't have any deer. We have one deer once that we've ever seen, and okay. that was a fluke, I think. So.
The other possibility is fertilizer. Have you been fertilizing in that area?
No.
Okay, so it's not like you're putting down too much nitrogen?
Okay, no, and no fertilizer.
Okay.
Yeah, we're stumped.
Nice pun.
I think it's a shade issue.
Yeah, I think it's most likely the shade. I had one lilac myself that was an old one that needed some renovation, and it kind of limped along, and it was in the shade from the neighbor's tree. Well, the neighbors removed those trees, and I'm now getting nice blooms on it. It was getting morning sun, but just not enough of the intense afternoon sun that a lot of plants do need. So
okay.
I'm thinking that's my guess for something that'll help you.
All right. Hey, thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And the next time you trim, take the biggest third out, cut them right to the ground. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Mike?
You know, that's the other thing is if you just have old wood on your lilac, they don't bloom as profusely as the younger stems would. So the rule of thumb with lilacs is one of the ways you can prune them, which there's many ways, is just get into the center of the shrub and with a saw and remove the largest stems and promote the new young growth that comes up, because it's that growth that will bloom more.
And about a third each year. And
yeah.
3 years, you've got it done.
Well, then you start over again.
Then you start over again. Joy in West Bend, hello to you. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. Since we've had not so great production this year, I have three questions.
Okay.
Mine is that question about the morning glories. My husband planted some in the vegetable garden on the edge of a lovely arching bean trellis. And now we have great morning glories, and it seems like for the past couple of years we're having real trouble starting our beans there, our climbing beans. So I was wondering, is there any toxicity issue with morning glories?
I'm not aware of a toxicity issue, although just the sheer vigor of morning glories, and once they start receding, and I can use my own yard as an example, we planted morning glories years ago, and the seed set is unbelievable, and all the seed doesn't germinate in spring. It germinates through the entire summer. So my guess is you're probably seeing a pretty aggressive resurgence of morning glories each year that's probably displacing the ability of the beans to do well. But again, I'm not sure of any sort of a toxicity issue or you know, those morning glories negating competition for any reason besides their vigor.
Okay, so I should just pull them out.
Yeah, get them out when they're young. You know, before they start twining is the goal.
Yes.
Okay. Lost cause this year, but I'll work on it next year. The other thing is, next item is, my husband is Mr. Mulch. He's used for years newspapers and just chunks of straw on that, and that seemed to work real well. The straw breaking down added to nutrients to our garden. But then he wanted to try something different, so he got a big load of leaves from the city that collects people's piles of leaves.
Oh.
And under that, he uses bicycle boxes for cardboard. And this year, it just seems like we haven't had very good production at all. I don't know if it's...
Could have been the leaves.
It could be a couple different things. And I'll run with my idea. You're putting down a lot of straw, a lot of leaves, a lot of cardboard, a lot of brown. And whenever you compost, you try to want to balance your green and your greens and your browns. If you get too much brown, it sucks up all the nitrogen from your soil.
Uh-huh.
And then nothing will want to grow. So I think you'd want to balance it out with some more like compost, manures, maybe even a nitrogen fertilizer. That'll help things continue to break down as well as allow some nitrogen for the plants to grow, give them a little boost of growth.
Okay.
And the other issue is you don't know what the leaves were. If there were black walnut, for example, leaves in among those, that the juglon in those leaves could have an effect on your plants.
Yeah.
Some plants, at least.
I think you got a combination of things. I would... only get leaves from a source where you know what the leaves are, and then I would come in and try to boost those nitrogen levels one way or another.
Yeah.
Maybe it's going to be putting down sort of legume cover crop that you can till in later on, or just finding a nitrogen source.
Okay.
And then my third question was about squash problems. Last year we had wonderful, wonderful squash production, but this year we've had... squash bugs. We've had the thing that gets in the vine.
Squash vine borer. Yeah.
And we have white powder on the leaves.
Powdery mildew.
Yeah.
So, would diatomaceous earth have helped any? Or
No, because what you have to do is, for the squash vine borer, that's the one we have the most problem in our community garden. You have to treat the stem with some product, some sort of labeled insecticide at a certain time when the adults are flying and will be laying the eggs, and that's how you control that one. There's a lot of other recommendations. I've heard people say plant radishes around them. We tried that didn't work, not for us. Some people have said you wrap the stems. You'll find a method that will work best for you, but it's for the squash vine borer is to just protect that stem early in the season before the eggs are laid into it. For the powdery mildew, we're going to be looking at, it's mostly going to be a cosmetic problem for the garden. It may affect yields, but for the typical home gardener, it does not. And then for the squash, squash bug on there?
Yeah.
Yeah, you could probably knock that off with maybe a bit of a insecticidal soap or some other appropriately labeled product. We get those in the garden and Honestly, we're so concerned about the squash vine borer, we let that one slide by.
Okay. There you have it, Joy. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Bill and DePere, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, thank you. I have a variegated dogwood in my front yard that I saw off at the ground every year, every spring.
Yeah.
And this year it leafed out just fine, but now the leaves are turning brown, particularly near the base of the plant. And I guess one thing I might mention is it's quite near where a Korean lilac that died of verticillium was. Any idea what that might be?
Mark?
Tough to say. You know, verticillium, my understanding is it's pretty quick. If it's going to take out your dogwood, it would do it quickly. If it's any consolation at all, our variegated dogwoods at Rotary Gardens, in which we have probably 40 or so, are all very spotted. They had a very tough year with the humidity and moisture regime, and a lot of that is from bottom to top. So we as I sit here, we don't have a real good-looking variegated dogwood, to be honest. So Mike alluded to sanitation earlier. It'd be very important to make sure you get all those leaves out of there this fall, and I wouldn't assume it's a wilt issue at this point.
Yeah. The leaves on the tips of the branches are look pretty normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, those might have some better ventilation being at the top, and if it is a leaf spot disease, that's going to be more pronounced on the lower branches where there's higher humidity, less sunlight, and it'll just be able to get a hold on those leaves better. When you get to the upper parts of the plant with more sun, more ventilation, you're going to have fewer disease problems.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have one other question.
Okay.
My potatoes have got little warts on them. They're kind of light tan. They really almost rub off just with your fingers.
Scab.
Any idea what that is?
I always thought it was a pH issue.
Yeah, it could be. But they look scabby. Is that right?
No, not really. They're very tiny little things.
I think we need to be on the same page as to what your problems are. Once again, get the sample into your county extension office or a picture into one of your local educators, and we can do a little better diagnosis that way.
Yeah.
Sometimes over the radio, it's a little hard.
All right. Thanks for calling. And Dennis in Delavan, on to you. Hi, Dennis.
Hi there. Thank you, fellas, for taking my call.
Sure.
We've had trouble growing castor beans lately because there's some new variety, it seems, that has a kind of a brown or a reddish leaf, and they haven't done well this year. And I was wondering, I know I've heard it's illegal to have the other kind of castor beans, the old-fashioned ones, which we used as a beautiful foundation plant in the past. And I was wondering if we could get those somewhere and plant them in Michigan.
Well, to my understanding, I don't know that castor beans are illegal at this point. And I think many people don't realize they're extremely poisonous, particularly the seeds themselves have a concentrated poison. At Rotary Gardens, we grow about 7 varieties, including the maroon leaf ones you alluded to. There's a lot of great varieties like Carmen Cedar Red, New Zealand Purple. The list goes on and on. But we also grow a lot of the old-fashioned ones, including a variety called Zanzibariensis. And that's a green leaf variety that gets, in our summers, 12, almost 15 feet tall.
That's what I used to have.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, get a hold of me at Rotary Gardens. I can help guide you to the seeds because we find a lot of those larger green leaf varieties will rarely form seed. We're not so concerned about flower formation and seed formation, but it was also a very poor year for us in terms of height on our castor beans. We don't have any over 8 feet, and we've grown monsters well over 12 to 15 feet, as I mentioned. So, you know, the water was there, the heat was there. We do some supplemental fertilization as well, but I was surprised as well. But it's a wonderfully tropical-looking plant, and if there's a concern about the poisonous nature, people should avoid it entirely. But it's a great ornamental.
Yes, well, thank you. I'll come to the Rotary Gardens and look for you then.
All right, great. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Or you can just go online to the rotarygardens.org and probably shoot an email to Mark Dwyer, and he can maybe help you out. So that's another way to do it. And let's turn to Gordon in Fort Atkinson next. Hi, Gordon.
Hello.
Thanks for
calling.
Can
you hear me?
Yeah. Yes, we can.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I have a weekend property in Adams County that I'm going to have to change the grade around a building.
And I have just this wonderful mature white pine. It's like 22 inches in diameter at the base that I'm going to have to cut into some of the root.
Ooh.
When is it safe to do this, or is it safe to do it, or can I save the trees?
I'm glad you are calling beforehand. I always get this question after they've done the damage. There's an area around a tree called a critical root zone. It has nothing really to do with the drip, you know, the canopy of it, how big it is. It's just how big of a root system you've got going on. And you mean, you know, the diameter, you take that number, you multiply it by 1.5, and that's going to roughly give you the radius around the tree that you need to protect with your life to keep anything negative from happening to that tree. So if you're going to be cutting into that area, you could be doing damage to the tree. If you're going to be putting soil on top of that area, you could be doing damage to the tree. If you're pouring concrete slab over it, you can be doing damage around the tree. So the question is, are you going into that area?
I could stay maybe like 4 feet from it.
From the trunk?
From the trunk,
yeah. Oh, so you're going to be getting into that problem. So if you're wanting to protect this tree, then what I recommend is getting a hold of a certified arborist in that area who can come out and is able to give you some guidance on what are some techniques you can do to help preserve that tree during the construction process if you have to do the project like this.
It's going to be dicey.
Yeah, it's going to be close because those can be really sensitive trees, but you're calling beforehand and there can be options for you, but you're going to need someone who can go out and walk the site with you to tell you what those options will be.
Okay. Right. I've been to the website. I know there's some around.
So. All right, good. Thanks for calling, Gordon. Good luck with those trees. Yeah, you hate to lose something like that. Joyce and Mequon, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a butterfly garden that I planted for my daughter, who is handicapped, and she was afraid of butterflies. And we have an arbor in the garden with some seeding there. And on the outside of the arbor, I planted, you're going to hate to hear this, a trumpet vine. Some people call it, I think, flame vine. And I put the roots in four 5-gallon containers in order to contain the roots. But like naughty little children, the roots climbed out of the pots and went down into the ground, and now I have trumpet vine everywhere. It's loaded with blooms right now. The hummingbirds love it, and I'm heartbroken that I'm going to have to either dig this out and throw it away or put it somewhere else. And I'm wondering if there is any way to contain this. I've seen it growing in some people's yards away from trees, and apparently they can cut grass around it and so forth, but maybe bigger containers. Is there any way to deal with trumpet vine, keeping it contained better?
Yeah. Huh.
Well, the short answer is no if it's open planted in the soil, and you're encountering what's happened with the roots sneaking out and doing their thing. What you're going to need to do first and foremost is to separate your containerized trumpet vine from all those rootings. And whether it's hand digging or an herbicide, it's an absolute nightmare once it gets going. And the more you try to dig it, the more aggressive it seems to be. I'm thinking a way to maybe deal with it is keep it containerized in a larger container where it's not going to sneak out, where you're, you know, a little more vigilant with it rooting beyond the container. And bringing those containers in the unheated garage. The plant needs to experience dormancy. So if you can get it under 40 degrees and where that container is not going to freeze solid, it should experience dormancy and you can bring it out each year. But again, never letting it establish in the soil because you're already going to have a headache dealing with those portions of the plant that are in the soil. And the various botanic gardens I've worked at, we've spent a decade trying to remove trumpet vine rootings. You know, it just keeps coming back. And it's absolutely beautiful vine, I agree. So your big choice is whether to try this experiment or get rid of it. And I wish you the best.
Yeah.
Okay, I will do that. I will dig those big pots out, put them in the garage over winter, and put them back out next summer, and I'll try to be a little more careful. The thing is that these pots, I did cover them with just maybe an inch of soil, and then, of course, when the vines come up and they go over the arbor, the leafing of the vines is prolific, and you can't
can't really see where those little roots are going. They're very sneaky.
Right. Well,
all right.
Thank you very much for calling. They are nasty. Pamela in Fontana, we turn to you next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks. I have a problem with a slope under a tree. So I have a, it's a maple tree, and I look out my, the window, it's on the side of my house, and the maple tree is flat, but shortly after the trunk, there's a slope, and it's a pretty steep slope. So it was just dirt, and I think the only thing holding the dirt there was the roots of the tree. So I picked and raked and loosened up enough soil to plant some English ivy, thinking that could compete with the roots and maybe form a ground cover. And so I'm playing this game where I'm trying to contain the erosion with the ivy, but the ivy's not flourishing because of the erosion. So the question is, can I overlay some soil or some organic material, or should I go with mulch, and will that help the ivy to thrive more? It is growing, but just slowly, painfully slowly.
Yeah, and how big is the, how steep is the slope?
It's pretty steep. It's probably 30 degrees.
It's
really
30 degrees?
Steep.
Okay.
Well, there's a lot of challenges with a maple, which is presumably shallow-rooted.
Shallow-rooted, yeah.
Right. You'll have some fast water flow going across that space. And the challenge with establishing ivy is just, as you alluded to, trying to minimize that erosion. There are other ground covers out there that would do well also, but you really can't add too much soil, of course, because of raising the grade around that tree isn't going to be good. But I've seen situations like that where people will put in logs, essentially parallel to the grade of the slope, to help slow that water down, and the logs eventually start to rot as the ivy establishes. So you're creating mini terraces to slow that water down.
And
it sounds like with you want to keep the tree, so you can't do anything significant with permanent terracing without losing the tree. So,
certainly,
you know, the ivy will eventually catch and get going. And there'll probably be a day in about 10 years where you wish you hadn't planted it. But the trick now is getting it established. So
10 years of dirt isn't my friend either.
No.
Yeah, right.
That's right.
But in the meantime, too, to come in with some wood mulch or even the leaves will help give that a little bit of protection in that area.
Okay.
And will help minimize maybe some of the impact of water. You'll probably still get some runoff. But I like the idea of logs and combine it with some sort of organic matter like that.
Okay.
That should be quick fix.
All right.
Terrific. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. And John in Green Bay, hello.
Yeah, thank you. Real quickly, could you mention the names of the new varieties of elms that are really good, to sustain against the Dutch elm disease, please?
Okay.
Sure thing. There's a couple of different elms, and if I would encourage you to get on the Morton Arboretum website. I think if you just Google that, you'll get on there and look into their elm breeding program. But there's a couple different elms. There's one called Donata Charm. There's another called, I believe, Vanguard. There's also what's called the Morton Elm, which was one of their first that was offered. And there's another name for that. I can't think of the trade name, but there are five in the series, and they were bred by a Dr. George Ware, W-A-R-E. And again, if you get online, you'll be able to find those. I'm having a kind of a mental lapse here, but...
And it's the Morton...
Morton Arboretum out of Lisle, Illinois. That's western suburbs.
Okay.
And they've been growing there for many years. I was actually there just 2 days ago, and we have all those elms at the gardens, and we've been very happy with them, and they've done very well. And again, the growth rate is superior, 2 to 3 feet a year.
And so, John, take a ride to the Rotary Botanical Gardens in Janesville, Wisconsin, and take a look at the elms there, or go online. And Mark Dwyer, Mike Maddox, thank you so much for being with us on this edition of Garden Talk.